Blog Talk Radio.
Good morning, everyone. This is Johnny Tan, author of From My Mama's Kitchen, Food for the Soul, Recipes for Living. Welcome to my weekly From My Mama's Kitchen talk radio show. My guest for this morning is acclaimed Southern writer Michael Morris. Michael and I will be discussing about his latest novel titled Man in the Blue Moon. The book uses the oral history his grandfather had passed along to him about the turn of the century Florida during World War I. Unfortunately, Michael is running a little late, so we're going to give him a few minutes to call in before we get the show started. Please accept my apology. We're just going to hang on for a few minutes and let Michael get his call in to us. Hello, Michael. Can you hear me?
Yes. Hi. How are you?
Just fine. Glad you had a chance to get with us.
Yeah. I'm sorry. I was a little delayed. I got tied up on another call.
Okay. No problem at all. But good morning to you and welcome to From My Mama's Kitchen Talk Radio. So how are you doing this morning?
I'm doing great. Thanks. Where are you located?
I am in Dallas, Texas. It's wonderful out here today.
Okay, great. Yeah, well, I'm in Birmingham, Alabama, so we're on the same time zone at least.
That's correct. So anyway, I wanted to talk about your book, Man in the Blue Moon. It's a great book. The storyline is perfect for the current economic challenges we're facing in America. You know, it's amazing how history repeats itself. I know your book is fiction, but a lot of it is truth at the same time. So it's a wonderful read, and it has wonderful, great details and very captivating. So congratulations.
Well, thank you very much. I appreciate it. And we're really excited. The book just came out last week. Mm-hmm. And so far, we're getting some good reviews.
Fantastic. Please give us a quick walkthrough of your life from childhood to the present moment.
Well, sure. I'm a native of Florida. In fact, I'm a fifth-generation Floridian. But I'm from the northern part of the state, which is very southern, if you can't tell by my accent. But I grew up in a small paper mill town, and my mom and I were in an abusive household with my biological father when I was very young. Mm-hmm. And around five, we were able to get out, and we lived next door to my grandparents. Mm-hmm. Literally, I was about 50 feet from their back doorstep. So a big part of my childhood was spent with my grandparents in their home, listening to their stories. And, of course, one of the stories is what fueled Man in the Blue Moon. Mm-hmm. I did not start writing until much later in life. I had a teacher in high school who encouraged me to write, but I was from this paper mill town, and literally my worldview was that writers lived in New York or Paris, or if they were from the South, they were eccentric alcoholics. I mean, that's really what I thought. So I went on and majored in public relations, and I thought, well, I'll use my writing ability to write press releases and video scripts, which I did for a pharmaceutical company. And then around 31, I started taking inventory of my life and realizing, you know, how our situation could have been so much different if we wouldn't have had my grandparents to step in and help us get out. Mm-hmm. And that's when I wrote my first novel, A Place Called Wiregrass, which is actually about a woman who flees an abusive marriage and doesn't have family to support her, but she does have a family within the community who step in and help her through that. So Man of the Blue Moon is my fourth novel. And again, it's based on a true story that my grandfather would always share growing up in the panhandle of Florida about a man on the run for murder who actually was shipped to his family in a crate.
That's very interesting. I know I read the book. It's a wonderful book. When did you realize you enjoy writing?
Well, you know, I really can't think of a particular moment from my childhood. When my teacher in high school told me that I was a good writer, it really spoke to me because I was a C student at best, and it was the first time someone had told me I could do anything well related to school. So that was really the time it cemented for me. But earlier in my childhood, I mean, I have to say I had a very active imagination. I would come up with elaborate play world ideas, and I would eavesdrop on my grandparents' conversations, and my great aunt would come up every evening for supper with my grandmother, and I would listen to their stories and think of movies in my head. So I think all of that fueled the writing that eventually happened. From childhood, I remember playing, like I had a newspaper I owned, and I would write little stories. So that was probably the first time that I started writing and enjoyed it and saw it, you know, just like a play activity more than anything else.
Right. I could certainly relate to that because when I was growing up, that's basically what it is in Malaysia, that is. And what was interesting about it is that the adults would be talking and I would be like hanging out over there listening to all the wonderful stories. And that's when you learn about all the relatives and all the happenings that's going on. You really don't watch the tube, basically the TV, to get all that information.
Yeah, and that's what I love about storytelling. I mean, it just crosses countries, it crosses cultures. I mean, you're in Malaysia hearing these stories. I'm in Perry, Florida, this little paper mill town, hearing these stories. But it fuels our imaginations. And much like you, I heard about ancestors I never knew from my grandparents, and I would come up with these movies in my head. But as a result of it, I feel like I know all of these people who lived before me.
Yeah, it's a, some sort of a thing where you want to go back in history and kind of be with them because it's so real. I mean, obviously, it is a real story about your ancestors, your relatives, and so forth. So it's quite engaging. I feel like there's a lot more warmth in it than actually reading book.
Exactly. I agree with you 100%. And people ask me, did I grow up wanting to be a writer? Did I grow up around big readers? No, I didn't. But I did grow up around storytellers. And as a result of what you're talking about, my grandfather lived to be 101.
Wow.
And this is the same grandfather who gave me the idea for Man in the Blue Moon. But when he died last year in June, we were at the cemetery, and of course, we're at the family burial plot, and I could walk down the row of graves all the way back to my great grandparents and tell you a story about each person because of the stories I knew from my grandparents. And that is such a gift. I realize that. I mean, it's a gift of who you are and where you come from and a sense of place, too.
Right. Believe me, it beats Ancestry.com. Nothing against them. But
Yes. It's much more interesting. You're right. When you actually hear it. And, you know, we were fortunate to have those storytellers in our lives.
Yeah. And, again, these are the things that sometimes we don't realize it's spending the people when they're alive that's far more important and hearing firsthand information. And the beauty of it is that you do have an opportunity to ask questions.
Yes, and get, absolutely.
Right, and get answers that otherwise would not have a chance to have gotten having that, you know, you just reading about it, so to speak. So it's a big difference.
Yeah. In my life, I was fortunate to have relatives live a long, long life. my grandmother, unfortunately, died relatively young at 72, but her sister lived to be 96, and my grandfather, of course, was 101. And I spent a lot of time with them separately and would hear stories. And, you know, the older people get, the veneer tends to wear off, and they'll tell it, whether it's good or bad.
Right.
And so you really get a good representation of what the truth is.
That's true.
I just enjoyed it. I enjoyed spending time with them and hearing these stories.
That's true. Very, very true about that. So I knew you mentioned this. You really did not grow up around situations where people read a lot, I guess, in some cases. But did you have any particular authors that aspire you in terms of being a writer?
Well, I tell you what happened. I started writing, I started reading seriously after college. And I, you know, was trying to reinvent myself, so to speak. I thought if you had a Southern accent, people thought you were stupid. And I had to be professional and cleanse myself of my accent. And I was working for a U.S. senator in Florida. And one morning, driving to work, I was listening to NPR. And I heard this woman's voice. And I can only describe it as honey dipped. It was a beautiful mm-hmm. voice. She was reading a story about a weatherman in Memphis, Tennessee, who had come from a rural part of the state and had reinvented himself. Mm-hmm. And he was now on television as a weatherman, and his mother was dying, and he was visiting her in the hospital, and he had to come to terms with who he really is.
Mm-hmm.
And that story spoke to me in such a powerful way, because in essence, I realized that's what I was trying to do, wash mm-hmm. myself of my heritage. And the woman was Lee Smith, a great Southern writer, and I went out that night and bought the short story collection she was reading from on mm-hmm. NPR.
Mm-hmm.
And truly, reading her stories is what inspired me to think that I had some stories to tell as well.
Mm-hmm.
Another author who had great influence on me is Pat Conroy.
Mm-hmm.
And The Prince of Tides is one of my all-time favorite novels. And mm-hmm. I read it, you know, often, once a year at least. And he writes about the coast, the beautiful coastal setting, and the hurts of people and how they get over it, and the search of redemption. And all of that spoke to me on a personal basis. So I think those two writers
mm-hmm.
really helped fuel me. And then others like Flannery O'Connor, her humor, mm-hmm. And Eudora Welty, too. Those are writers that inspire me. So mainly it is a Southern collection that I turn mm-hmm. to, because mm-hmm. that's where I live and that's what I know.
Very interesting. Well, Pat Conroy also says some wonderful things about you as being one of his favorite Southern writers, so that must be a big thing for you.
Oh, I was thrilled to get that quote. And I'll tell you, that quote came about on one of the worst days I've had in probably 2 years,
uh-huh.
so I'll never forget it. But I got an email that evening from him with the quote, and I was just mm-hmm. thrilled, because I don't think you can get any better than Pat Conroy. He's just a wonderful writer.
Mm-hmm.
He's so talented. And anything he writes, I want to read. And I've loved every book he's written.
That's wonderful. Do you use your writing as an escape to express yourself in some ways, in terms of living a storyline, or is just to entertain others?
That's a great question. It's a little bit of both, quite frankly. I mean, mm-hmm. writing is an escape for me, particularly, you know, on bad days, or if mm-hmm. I've got something horrific I'm dealing with in my life at the moment.
Yeah.
Writing is something I turn to as an escape, as another world you can create with other characters. And mm-hmm. what happens is I end up getting inspiration from these characters, too, because I tend mm-hmm. to write about characters who are going through what I call life hurricanes.
Mm-hmm.
They're going through difficult circumstances, seeking redemption, trying to be a better person and come out the other side intact. And those stories inspire me on a personal level.
Mm-hmm.
So for me, it is a little bit of both. It's a way to escape and to entertain at the same time.
Interesting. In your various writings, what life experiences really influence your writing most?
Well, I think growing up in an abusive household very mm-hmm. early in life did, you know, form my writing
mm-hmm.
because, you know, I know the power of words. I've heard words used in a derogatory way. I've heard
mm-hmm.
words used to hurt people, to take power over people. And then I've had words used to lift me up, like the teacher I mentioned in high
mm-hmm,
school.
Mm-hmm.
She was the first person to tell me I could write. I'll never forget it. We had to write an essay entitled Where I'll Be When I Turn Age 30.
Mm-hmm.
And again, I was a C-minus student probably. But she looked at me when she read them aloud in class and said, "You have real talent." And I'm 45 years old, and I can relive that moment like
yeah.
it was yesterday, because it was the first time that I really realized how powerful words could be to lift you up, too.
Mm-hmm.
Not only to tear you down, but to lift you up. And as a consequence of, you know, being in this abusive household and my mom
mm-hmm.
and I escaping, we were able to live next door to my grandparents, where I got that unconditional love.
Mm-hmm.
I got to be around these great storytellers. So I think that moment in my life has formed my writing and where I am and what led me to write, quite frankly.
Very interesting. That's wonderful. You talk about unconditional love and so forth, because that's the fuel that actually fires us up, and especially at the young age that you were, and realizing that you can make certain things happen based within your own self and having someone validate the talent that you have within yourself.
Yes. I mean, I'm so grateful for my grandparents, you know, and this is grandparents. Awareness Day was Sunday.
Mm-hmm.
We're supposed
yes.
to celebrate grandparents this week. So
right.
I really do celebrate them for the gifts that they gave me. And they gave me a sense of where I come from. And that
mm-hmm.
that is important in
right.
my writing, is the sense of place
mm-hmm.
and belonging.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the gift that my grandparents gave me. And then also mentors in my life, like my
right.
English teacher, Linda Maltzby. My second novel, Slow Way Home, is actually dedicated to her
mm-hmm.
as a
mm-hmm.
as a thank you for the inspiration she gave me and what she did to lead me to eventually write.
That's wonderful. What inspired you to write Man in the Blue Moon?
Well, as I mentioned, my grandfather was a great
mm-hmm.
storyteller. I mean, he was the best storyteller I've known. He would sit on the edge of his chair and wave his hand, and it was almost hypnotic. And he was such a good storyteller that you might have to get him to tell the story two or three times to figure out what's fact and what's fiction.
Yeah.
And if you called him on the carpet about it and said, you know, things aren't quite right here, he'd kind of grin and say, well, I was just trying to dress it up a little bit. But he was a character for sure. But one story he told always stayed with me. And the Panhandle of Florida around the Gulf owned a country store, and when he
mm-hmm.
was adult, he'd pick up a delivery
mm-hmm.
on the that was coming from Georgia on the steamboat.
Mm-hmm.
And so they got to the porch in Apalachicola, Florida. Their father unloaded, I'm sorry, the man working on the
mm-hmm.
steamboat unloaded this big crate. They took
mm-hmm.
it back to their father's country store. Their
mm-hmm.
daddy popped the lid, and a man climbed out of the box.
Mm-hmm.
The man was a distant relative, and he had been shot in the night in secret.
Mm-hmm.
He was on the run for a murder he claimed he didn't commit.
Mm-hmm.
And the truth that my grandfather knew it was
mm-hmm.
that the man had been charged with killing his wife and her lover,
mm-hmm.
and he had been exonerated, but his in-laws were still out for vengeance. They
mm-hmm.
thought that he did it. And
mm-hmm.
so he was shipped to my great-grandfather, his second cousin, for safe
mm-hmm.
passage.
Mm-hmm.
And I always knew I wanted to turn to this story because it really haunted me.
Mm-hmm.
I would get him to tell it throughout my life, and
mm-hmm.
you know, as a child and as an adult. And I knew I wanted to do something with it, but it wasn't until my grandfather turned 99
mm-hmm.
and I realized, gosh, he's already lived so long. He has his mind. I have to interview him about this, and I have to do something with it before he goes away and takes the story with him.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's what inspired Man in the Blue Moon.
That's fantastic. How did you come up with the title itself? Because the title is really a wonderful catch.
Well, you know, I appreciate that. I tried to think of something that would be a little mystical, because the
yeah.
man who is shipped in the box in Man in the Blue Moon is from the North Georgia mountains.
Mm-hmm.
And the people of the culture in that area is documented in the series Foxfire,
mm-hmm.
which was from the early 70s, that kind of recounts this Appalachian heritage.
Yeah.
They believed that certain people had the ability to heal, that they could pull thrush out of a child, or they could
mm-hmm.
pull fire out of a person's body,
mm-hmm.
or stop bleeding.
Mm-hmm.
And so I made Lanier originally from this area,
mm-hmm.
and he has this sort of gift of healing that not everybody in the community is happy with,
mm-hmm.
and it ends up being his undoing in the story. So, you know, I have that mystical ability. I knew I wanted to incorporate the moon.
Yeah.
And where it ties in is he is actually shipped in a grandfather clock box. And the clock company is called the Blue Moon Clock Company. Mm-hmm. So that's the tie to Man and the Blue Moon.
Interesting. So give us a quick synopsis of the book.
Well, as I mentioned, Lanier Stillis is on the run for a murder he claimed he didn't commit. He's shipped to Apalachicola, Florida, in this crate for his second cousin. And his second cousin is no longer in town. He has an opium addiction, and he's run off and left his wife, Ella Wallace, struggling against foreclosure from the debt he's accumulated. And she's trying to raise these three sons. And she reluctantly lets this man stay because he comes up with a scheme to cut timber on her property and to pay off the note and save her home. But the banker in town is just determined to take her property because Ella has a artesian spring on her property, and local Indians believe that it has medicinal properties, that it is like a healing spring. And you soon find out the banker is in cahoots with a national radio evangelist at the time, a very celebrated figure, who wants to develop one of these spring retreats, which were so popular in the early 20th century, on her land. And that's why they're going to try to get this land at all cost. And Lanier becomes an obstacle. And as I mentioned, Lanier has this ability to heal, being from Appalachia. And the evangelist and the banker use it against Ella and try to turn the community against him.
Right, right.
And that becomes his undoing in the novel.
What I like about it also, it has the light romance in it, and it's about people. In the end, it's about real life, real situation, and how you deal with that. And it really touches the soul in terms of, hey, you know, do you take advantage of people, or do you help to work within what you have to make it, to survive? The resiliency within oneself, so to speak. So that's a wonderful story in itself. Did you have to do a lot of research before writing this book?
Yeah, I had to do a ton of research. And quite frankly, I think that's what it writing it sooner than when I did, because my other novels are contemporary. And this one is set in 1918, where you have the end of World War One, you have the women's suffrage movement, and you also have the Spanish flu epidemic that swept the country. So those three events are crucial to the novel. I started with oral history from my grandfather, as I mentioned, on his 99th birthday. I began recording him, telling his story, what was life like during this time, what was Christmas celebrations like, what, you know, every detail I could think of. And also, I scoured documentaries. There was one that was just terrific that PBS had done on the Spanish flu epidemic that swept the country. And also, the University of Florida was very helpful. They provided microfilm of the 1918 Apalachicola newspapers where the novel is set, and that was extremely helpful to me. And there were a couple of things that I found in the research that I pulled into the story as far as plot points. When I was researching the newspaper of Apalachicola, I found that much later in time, there was a minister in the area who tried to claim that that part of Florida was the original Garden of Eden. And it sounds preposterous, and of course, argument never took ground, but he was trying to go back to the book of Genesis and claim that the river in Apalachicola forks a certain number of times, and that there's flora there that can't be found anywhere else in the world. So I took that, and that becomes the evangelist's charge. He believes that Ella's land was actually the original Garden of Eden, and why he is just determined to commercialize that and create this spring retreat to get all these people from other parts of the country to come by train into this area and make them a lot of money, quite frankly. But that incorporates itself into the novel, too. So it was research intensive, but I found that I really enjoyed it. I enjoyed the whole process.
Is that the secret or something that's interesting that you found out while doing your research, or there's some other stuff that you also found out that was quite interesting that never actually got in the book?
Well, yeah, that was the main thing I discovered that I incorporated into the novel, this Garden of Eden claim. Mm-hmm. Because when you're writing the novel, of course, you have to have conflict at every turn, mm-hmm. obstacles the character has to face to try to achieve their goal. And that becomes a big obstacle in the story. The other thing that was quite interesting to me, knowing the area of Apalachicola, Florida, and this low-lying water table and this kind of marsh, swampy area mm-hmm. outside of town, I thought that rice could be produced there because the landscape, water table, is very similar to South Carolina, of course, mm-hmm. where there was rice mm-hmm. Produced. So I planned to put that in the story, but not really thinking it had ever happened. I just thought the circumstances would lend itself to it. And mm-hmm. then lo and behold, when I was researching the newspapers, in 1918, there was a state chemist who came to town and tried to encourage the local people to grow rice. Because it was fertile for rice production. Mm-hmm. And that never took off for one reason or another. But it validated my claim, and that's part of the novel as well.
Very interesting. That's a wonderful story. We talk about how your grandfather's story really helped you to formulate the book itself. What other things that your grandfather did in terms of his storytelling style and so forth that gave you a unique flavor in writing this book?
Well, he had a certain way of speaking mm-hmm. that really has kind of died out. It was a vernacular that I don't hear a lot of people use.
Mm-hmm.
And again, we're talking about the panhandle of Florida,
yeah,
right around, right below Alabama. For example, if he thought someone felt offended by something he said or did, he would say, "Well, I beg apologies," instead of saying "I'm sorry," which is really a beautiful way of saying it. So these were the things that I tried to incorporate into the novel too, of mm-hmm. way of speaking, the vernacular that's known to that area, mm-hmm. and a different place and time. Mm-hmm. So that was a gift he gave me. And then the other thing is, you know, he actually owned the Foxfire series, the books mm-hmm. I mentioned mm-hmm. that document the people of Appalachia and North Georgia.
Mm-hmm.
And through his book, I came up with the idea to make Lanier, the man who shipped in the crate, this mystical healer. So that's mm-hmm. another gift he gave me as well.
That's wonderful. That's very exciting. The setting of any storyline is very important, and of course you use the integral part of Florida, that part of Florida where you wrote about Apalachicola and so forth. Is that something that just ties in into the book itself, or is it something that's unique about the place that you felt like this is the time to highlight it for its uniqueness?
Well, I appreciate you bringing that up because I love the mm-hmm. area. Mm-hmm. Apalachicola, Florida is a quaint little town of about 2,500 people, and it has a really unique balance of local oystermen. Mm-hmm. Anybody who has heard of it knows that Apalachicola is very famous for its oysters. You will find them at the best restaurants in Manhattan, Los mm-hmm. Angeles. But at the same time, you've got this kind of hardscrabble fisher community. And then you have tourists from Europe who come
mm-hmm.
there.
Mm-hmm.
For example, I've just written a story on Apalachicola, Florida, that's going to appear in Southern Living in November. Mm-hmm. And when I went to research the place for the piece, I was talking to this fisherman outside on the sidewalk, and mm-hmm. he had this beat-up cane fishing pole and a bicycle and was very kind of hardscrabble mm-hmm. and very nice. We were talking about the weather. And then I went inside a coffee shop, and there were two tourists from Scandinavia there. So I just think it's a really unique place with an interesting balance. historically, it's fascinating to me because before the Civil War, it was the third largest exporter of cotton, and the French government actually had a consulate based there. So, you know, there's a lot of history in this little tiny coastal community. I started my first novel, A Place Called Wiregrass, while on vacation at Apalachicola and St. George Island, which is a little island right across the bridge from the city. So I'm always going back there to write. Apalachicola has a reference in every novel I've written. And when I started to write Man in the Blue Moon, my grandfather grew up in a little town near there, so I decided to base the whole novel on Apalachicola, Florida, and to tie into this rich history that it has.
Right. That's wonderful. A lot of times now, the only time we hear about Apalachicola is about the hurricane coming in.
Yes. I told somebody that the other day. It's funny because, and I have to compliment you on being able to pronounce it. Most people cannot pronounce the name. And a gentleman at a book conference this past weekend in Naples, Florida, and he said, Apalachicola. He kind of stumbled over it. He said, I've seen it on the Weather Channel. I said, that's usually how most people know it because it's the one place that they always pinpoint the hurricane directions and where the hurricane going to come in at. So that's interesting you bring it up. It's a really quaint little town. And what's so interesting, when we first started talking, you talked about the parallels to the novel, the hard economic times and what we're facing today.
Right.
And interesting enough, the population of Apalachicola is 2,500 people today. In 1918, it was 2,300. So it really...
hasn't changed much,
No, it hasn't changed much. So it was real helpful for me to kind of picture it because it would be about the same size of population.
Right. Very interesting. Very, very interesting. What was the most difficult thing for you to write about in the book?
I just wanted to make sure that I had the historical details accurate. I didn't want to make it a history lesson. So for me, probably the most difficult thing was trying to sprinkle in these details of World War One, of the women's suffrage movement, which is sort of playing in the background as Ella, this woman that's kind of this well-to-do debutante from her past, has to come into her own and be her own person because she's facing all these obstacles of possible foreclosure. So I wanted to sprinkle those details in without it seeming like, you know, a big exposition of what the year is and what was going on. And I tried to do that by referencing in the store she runs, people coming in complaining that they couldn't get sugar. And she talks a little bit about how she's limited to sell the pound a week, which would tie it into what actually happened during the rationing of World War One. So that was probably the most difficult thing for me to kind of address in the story. But, you know, when you get past that, what I found, you know, people are people, regardless if they're living in 1918 or 2012. We still have the same longings. We still have the same desires. We oftentimes have similar hurts and heartaches. And that... once I realized that, then it was just like writing any other novel I would, but you've just got different circumstances going on as what's available to them as far as technology and also the world events that were occurring at that time.
That's very true. Very, very true about that. How did you develop the various characters in the book? Because you've been known by a lot of your reviewers, and I agree that there's a tremendous amount of authenticity of the voices of your various characters that you have in this book. Is it something that you studied and perfect over the years, or is this something that's a natural for you in terms of being able to come up and make all the characters extremely alive?
Well, thank you for that question. I grew up kind of a mimic. I could mimic people from early age, and I think that helps. You know, when I'm trying to envision a character, and the way the character would speak.
Mm-hmm.
When I'm developing characters, I usually take a little bit of somebody I know,
mm-hmm.
a little bit of somebody I might see in the airport or the mall and not ever know who they are, but just observe their mannerisms, and I mix it all together. And that's how I come up with a character. Now, one thing I did learn through taking writing workshops is there are a series of questions I will ask myself about the character. And I'll write a background on each character before I even start writing the novel.
Mm-hmm.
Everything from their favorite color to their hidden secret to their biggest fears. And I'll write all this out, and a lot of the information will never even make it into the novel. But it helps me to know that character inside and out so that
mm-hmm.
hopefully they will seem real to the reader.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. That's a very interesting approach. So as a male author, how challenging is it for you to develop your female characters?
You know, it's interesting. When I first wrote my novel, A Place Called Wiregrass, which was mm-hmm. my first book, as I mentioned, my mom and I were in an abusive household and had got out when I was very young. So I was writing about a woman fleeing an abusive marriage. She's kind of a good old girl. She's come from a hard life. She doesn't have any support of her family to help her, and she ends up working as a housekeeper for an elderly socialite. And the socialite's going to take her under her wing and show her how to start her life again. But the older woman ends up having to come to terms from a secret from her first marriage that she has to settle her demons before mm-hmm. she can move on. So writing that novel, I actually wrote it from Irma Lee, the main character's point of view, in her voice. I didn't know any differently. I just mm-hmm. thought it's her story. It needs to be told from her point of view. And I definitely think growing up around strong women helped me to formulate strong female characters. My mom, my grandmother's sister, these are the women I was around a lot, and they were all strong women in
mm-hmm.
different ways.
Mm-hmm.
So that's helped me a great deal in being able to put together strong female characters.
Very interesting. Do you see with Man in the Blue Moon as similar to what you have worked on in previous novels, or does this mark as a departure from your writing in a different direction, so to speak?
Well, it's interesting. My other novels have all been told in first person.
Right. Mm-hmm.
And, of course, when you write in first person, you're limited. You mm-hmm. can only present what the character is seeing or discovering at that time. In Man in the Blue Moon, I wrote it in a third person voice, just
mm-hmm.
sort of a godlike presence that's overlooking this whole town and seeing what's going on. And it was freeing in that sense to be able to move from character to character in telling this story and revealing things that maybe you could not reveal if you were focused just on one character's point of view. But at the end of the day, as I mentioned before, I mean, I'm still writing about characters who are going through what I call life hurricane moments,
mm-hmm.
where their life is totally turned upside down, and they have to get through the other side and get through this problem and become a changed person. And that's what's happening to Ella Wallace in Man in the Blue Moon. She's facing foreclosure of her home because of her husband's gambling addiction. He's run off and left her. She has three sons. She's never really had to take control of anything in her life. This is 1918. She's been this pampered woman, and she has to come into her own. And Lanier Stillis, the man who arrives in this crate, becomes this presence in her life who helps her develop herself
mm-hmm.
and to realize that she can do it and that she is worthy and valuable and has gifts and talents.
What would you like for your readers to gain from reading Man in the Blue Moon?
Well, you know, at the end of the day, I just try to write novels that I would like to read.
Mm-hmm.
And the greatest compliment I could get from a reader is if someone tells me that they read the novel and finished it, and then the next day they were still thinking about the characters, they were still thinking about the story. To me, that's when I realized I have done my job. And in this novel, like my others, I feel like it shows that the definition of family can be broadened. Mm-hmm. You know, family can be more than our blood relatives. Family can also be defined as those people in our lives who step up and help us when we are going through difficulties. And Lanier Stillis becomes family to Ella Wallace. Mm-hmm. He becomes her family member because he helps her, and people in the community become her family too. Mm-hmm. And I also think this is a novel about tolerance, something else that's timely for the time period we live in too. I think it's a novel about tolerance of those who we may not agree with, and certainly those who we don't share the same beliefs with.
Right. What are some of the other stronger lessons that you are trying to impart, whether it's subconsciously or consciously, in just telling the story about people, living, community, togetherness, the interdependency that we have to exist, coexist as a community? What other lessons that you think that can be gathered from this beautiful novel?
Well, I think the lesson is that we should not be so quick to judge other people. And, you know, that's on both sides, not only those who may be religious fundamentalists, but also people who are judging the religious fundamentalists. I mean, it's, you know, kind of a back and forth judging that goes on. And I think that's part of the message in the novel, is not to be so quick to judge others. Lanier becomes persecuted in the story because of this mystical ability to heal that he has,
that's
part of his culture from Appalachia.
Right.
And it's all because of judgment. Mm-hmm. And what was behind his particular judgment is greed. Mm-hmm. Greed of people wanting to take Ella's land and to develop it and to manipulate circumstances. So I think tolerance and judgment are two of the topics in the novel that hopefully come across pretty strongly.
Do you feel fear is another factor?
Yes, absolutely. And thank you for bringing that up, because Ella is very fearful. Mm-hmm. And she's obviously fearful that she's going to lose her home. I mean, these are tangible fears. But she carries another fear with her. Her aunt, who raised her, was a very fearful person, fearful of what people in the community would think, fearful of not wanting to step outside social boundaries. Mm-hmm. And so Ella is really concerned of what people think of her.
Mm-hmm.
She's, you know, kind of codependent in that sense.
Right.
And, you know, that's part of her fear of Lanier. She's attracted to him. And as you mentioned, they do have this kind of romantic relationship.
Mm-hmm.
But she's fearful of what people are going to think of her, because her husband is still out there somewhere, an opium addict. He's run off and left her, but he's still out there. She's got this man living on her property in 1918 in this small community. There is a lot of talk about that. And so she is fearful of what people think of her. And he helps to change her in that way and to show her that, you know, he's finished with that. He's been there. He grew up in Appalachia, was very uneducated, reinvented himself, married into this wealthy family in Georgia, and then his life was turned upside down when his wife was killed, and then his in-laws are out to kill him. So he's left all that behind him. He's finished with trying to please people and to live in fear, and he's trying to show her that she can also leave it behind as well.
That's very true. So where can someone go to buy your book, get more information about you, and keep up with your latest happenings?
Well, I have a website. It's michaelmorrisbooks.com. And people can go online and read the first chapter of the novel. And I'm kicking off a book tour beginning tomorrow. I'm going to be at the Carter Center in Atlanta, Georgia, talking about my grandfather in celebration of Grandparents Week, and how he encouraged me to write this novel through his storytelling. And then I'll be traveling all over the Southeast. So I hope people who live in the Southeast particularly will check out the events page and come and say hello when I'm at bookstores in their area.
That's wonderful. How has writing Man in the Blue Moon impacted you personally? I know this is your fourth novel. When I read this book, it's sort of personal. I'm sure every novel you've written is personal. But this one, I think it's about as close as home as you can get.
Yes, it is. And thank you for realizing that, too, and bringing this up. This novel is dedicated to my grandfather, who I mentioned lived to be 101 last year. And it is personal to me because it is his story. And that's the thing about writing. If we write our stories, then they're immortal. Mm-hmm. And even though my grandfather has gone on now, his story is still here, and people are reading his story. And mm-hmm. to me, that is the magic and the gift of writing, is that immortality.
Mm-hmm. What is next for you?
Well, I have a new novel that's scheduled to come out next year called The King of Floribama. Mm-hmm. It's about the longest-serving sheriff in Alabama who at 80 loses re-election. He gets in a car wreck, which isn't his fault, gets put in assisted living, and he rebels. Mm-hmm. He ends up walking out and going to Florida in search of a cousin he's always dreamed of working for on a citrus grove. Mm-hmm. And the cousin's long gone. The citrus grove's now Walmart. But he stays in this community. He actually starts working as a greeter at the Walmart, and mm-hmm. he befriends a migrant family. And when a hate crime happens to them, it catapults him back 40 years in time to a murder in which he sold his family out to save himself politically. Mm-hmm. And he has to come to terms with the fallout with his children and then try to make amends.
Wow, that sounds exciting.
It's different, you know. It's a mm-hmm. different type of movie. Book. I have a friend who runs the largest book club in the country. She's actually based in your neck of the woods. She's in Jefferson, Texas.
Uh-huh.
Her name is Kathy Patrick in the Pulpwood Queens, and mm-hmm. she's read that manuscript, and
yeah.
she's already set to make it a book club pick, and she is determined to get Clint Eastwood the manuscript because she said it's got his name all over it, playing this 80-year-old sheriff who's still very much a man in charge.
Yeah, yeah. That's wonderful. That's very exciting. You're right, because I know you mentioned about, you know, slip of the tongue there about movie, but all your books, I mean, at least the one that I've read, Man in the Blue Moon, and of course in this one coming up, I think it has that wonderful story about this is real life, this is everyday ordinary people, the things that we go through in life, the struggle, the triumph, the personal reflection that we do. It's all put in a very nice way, and it's written very well on paper by you, and that's wonderful.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. Yeah, I mean, I would love to see that happen, particularly mm-hmm. with this book, because I saw this as a movie in my head as I was writing it. That's how this played out. And one of the most fun questions I get when I go to book clubs, everyone wants to know who's going to play the different roles when it becomes a movie. And I love hearing the readers answer that, you know, who they think would be Ella and who they think would be Lanier. It's a fun question for book clubs to talk about.
Yeah, yeah. That's wonderful. What advice do you have for aspiring authors who are just starting out in finding their niche? Because I felt like the way you do your writing, you really have this tremendous amount of hold on the things that you write. The passion, everything flows naturally for you. So what advice do you have for young authors?
Well, I think you first just have to figure out what works for you mm-hmm. as far as what you're passionate about, the topics that you want to write about. For me, I grew up in the South. I grew up in a very small rural town in Florida, so that's where I turned to write. I mean, I set my stories there because I know the area so well and I have a passion for it. Also, I think we have to write the books we want to read,
mm-hmm.
period. Mm-hmm. Because if you start trying to write for the market, if you start trying to write 50 Shades of Grey, the next series, or another vampire series, the market's going to change quite frankly, probably before you get it done and ready to be published. And I think people have to write for themselves first and foremost. You've got to write the book you would want to go buy and pay money for. And then the other piece of advice that I got early on that has been a tremendous help to me is you have to crank out the story. Once you get going, just keep writing, keep writing, keep telling that story, sitting there day in, day out, go back to the story. And then once you finish the story on paper, then you go back and start editing it. Then you go back and start cleaning it up. Mm-hmm. Because the tendency is to go back and edit what you did yesterday. And the advice I got from another writer is if you do that, you're going to be a really good editor, but maybe never get your story out on paper.
Mm-hmm.
So the story comes first.
Very interesting. That's wonderful advice. And again, what I enjoy is the fact that you came from the approach of if you can talk, you can write, because it's all about storytelling.
That's right. Yeah. And, you know, one thing that has helped me being around storytellers is capturing dialogue and dialect, the way people talk. And I think that's another important piece of advice. If you hear somebody say something really unique, like my grandfather, I beg apologies instead of I'm sorry. Jot those lines down and use them and savor them.
Right. Well, I mean, in his case, that's full of grace, very humble.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, and it's just a unique way of expression that I've never heard anybody else use that is just in the area he grew up. It's how they would talk.
Right. That's interesting. By the way, we're coming close to the end of the show. Do you have a recipe for living life you would like to share with our listeners this morning?
Well, just to be authentic. You know, I want to be an authentic human being. I'm learning every day to speak the truth, and hopefully my voice is getting louder and louder. You know, I struggle with a lot of the same issues that my characters do in my novels, you know, fear, economic times. But I can always learn something from my characters, and that is to be courageous and to take chances.
Very interesting. That's a wonderful, sweet recipe for living. Basically, if you have love over fear, then you will experience harmony in everything you do.
I agree.
That's wonderful. Any final thoughts about Man in the Blue Moon?
Well, I appreciate you reading it, and I hope your readers will enjoy it as well. I mean, I just wanted to get my grandfather's story out there and present an entertaining story that hopefully will linger with readers after they finish the last page.
What some of the feedbacks have you received from your family members?
They've loved it. That's one thing I was wondering how that was going to go over because my grandfather had six brothers, and of course they're all deceased. He was the last to die, but his nephews and so forth, I've talked to them, and they've heard the story from their father, and I was wondering how they would interpret the novel, but they've loved it. And, of course, I've been thrilled with the reviews we've gotten. We've gotten a star with Publishers Weekly. So it's, you know, so far so good. I'm just really thrilled with the feedback I'm getting.
Anyone else in the family member that are aspiring authors?
None that I know of. If they are aspiring, they're not telling me. but, you know, I venture to say there are some writers in that family because they are big storytellers to this day. And it's always fun to go to these family reunions because they're all telling stories and they're all big talkers, as we say in the South.
Right.
But it's always a lot of fun to be around them.
They're probably intimidated by you.
Oh, no, I don't think so. I, you know, if they do want to write, I wish they would because I'd love to read their work, too. I know they would probably come at some of these stories a different way than me, so that would be real interesting to see their interpretations, too.
That's very true. That's very exciting. But I'm really happy for you because it seems like you found a wonderful niche and you are really doing a fantastic job in telling the stories about your experiences, your life experiences, which is, that's wonderful, because a lot of times writers just grab something off the air and everything is fantasy, so to speak, because we tend to be creative. We dream a lot, so we embellish a lot in some ways.
Right. Kind of like my grandfather, you know. He would tell those stories, and you'd have to get him to tell them three or four times to weed out the truth from fiction. So, yeah, that's what we do.
Very true, very true. Well, Michael, thank you for the great recipe for living that you had shared with us earlier, and for spending this hour with me on From My Mama's Kitchen Talk Radio. To all our listeners, thank you for being with us. Please join me next Tuesday morning. My guest will be author Martha Fitzgerald. Martha and I will be discussing about her latest novel titled The Courtship of Two Doctors. Set in the 1930s, the book is about a collection of nearly 800 courtship letters between two physicians. It is a compelling love story blended with an enticing history. For additional information about this show and future shows, please go to FromMyMamasKitchen.com. Thank you for listening and have a great week. Michael, thank you again and have a great day.
Thank you so much. I appreciate it.
Take care. Bye-bye.